Well, welcome back to the third in the series of these lectures. And today we move this series along in a number of ways. We move from the UK to the US. We move from media, which Peter Mandelson and Alistair Campbell really focused on, towards political polling, which is absolutely central in modern political campaigning and amongst political professionals. And we move from Blair to Clinton and beyond Clinton as well. Stanley Greenberg is the greatest political pollster in the world today. I know I say that every week, but it's always true. I don't know. How did we get this reputation for spin? He's more than that. He's a great political strategist, profound thinker about politics, and perhaps above everything else, he's really, really profoundly committed to the progressive cause. He started his career in Yale, where he was an academic for 17 years, and then he sort of drifted away and moved into politics, and he started doing polling and focus groups in somewhere called Macomb County, and he developed from this a whole new view of modernized progressive politics in the United States. And this was rooted in a new connection with middle-class voters and also a new coalition between poorer voters and middle-class voters as well. And this became the kind of core to much of President Clinton's project and to his re-election. I used it as well. I was struggling with the same kind of ideas in Britain, but Stan managed to articulate them far better than I could, particularly in a book called The Middle Class Dreams, which is a tremendous account of this period and of what it actually means to build a political project. This work was seminal to Clinton, and he was seminal to Clinton's re-election in 1992. Since then, he's worked with a great number of hugely impressive politicians, Nelson Mandela in his election, Ehud Barak in Israel, Tony Blair, and others as well. Stan always wants to win elections, but he wants most to change the world. He's one of those people that is shot through with progressive values and principles. I've worked with Stan for 10 years or so now. He's been more than a friend. He's been a mentor to me. And I think he's the very best example of a political professional. He will talk for half an hour or so, a bit more, and there will be the chance to ask questions. And if you wish to ask questions on the current political situation in the United States, the domestic situation, please do feel free to do so. Stan Greenberg.
Can you see me? Can you hear me? I assume you can. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think you need to be a bit louder, Stan.
Okay. Let me thank all of you for coming, and LSE for hosting me. And I want to thank Philip for the opportunity not just to give this presentation, but to work together over a decade in a whole series of campaigns. And while many of us lose our energy, somehow Philip seems to continue not just to maintain his energy, but to continue to allow the project to grow and adapt to a changing world. And so we keep working together, and particularly here in Britain, but always sharing our ideas about the places we work. For myself, I find myself in this odd niche of helping elect presidents and prime ministers, kings and queens, and other such people. I never could explain to my mother what I do for a living. I know Philip described me in some elevated terms as the best pollster in the world, but my mother always thought that meant I was the best upholsterer in the world and could help with the furniture, and I'm still not sure. Plus, I never really much liked the people who called themselves pollsters or political consultants, and so it took many, many, many years before I was willing to accept the identity, and I'm not sure I'm there. But for better or worse, that's what I do. I've had in the process the opportunity to be part of a important periods of change in the United States and Britain, but also in South Africa and in the Middle East and in Latin America, and to work for some fairly extraordinary leaders whose work carries on. Now, the starting point, however, is Macomb County, as Philip indicated. I go there in part because Philip has driven me back to the United States. At the moment, that seems a little less tumultuous than Britain. But in any case, I go back there because it really is the starting point for my involvement in politics, electoral politics, and in polling. But I started with Macomb County. Macomb County was a suburb of Detroit, Michigan. It was a county that was heavily Catholic, heavily blue-collar, but middle-class homeowners because of the good pay that came out of the auto industry, heavily union, heavily auto workers, progressive union, and a suburb that had given John Kennedy, when he ran for president, his largest suburban majority in America, and helped him win parts of the Midwest that gave him the presidency. And so Macomb County was very much at the heart of the modern Democratic Party, post-New Deal Democratic Party. The problem is that Macomb County went through a whole period of upheaval, centered above all on civil rights. And when the civil rights battle came north, and the urban riots and school busing and a whole range of issues centered on race, Macomb County, the whites, Catholics, auto workers of Macomb County shifted heavily Republican and voted 74% for Ronald Reagan in 1984. Now, my work as a pollster drawn out of academia really began then, because after that disastrous election, for reasons that are still not clear to me, the Michigan Democratic Party and the UAW asked me to go to Macomb County and to look at Macomb County as a way to center on the problems that the modern Democratic Party was having as it's lost its an overwhelming majority, landslide majority, to Ronald Reagan, and try to understand what had happened there. Now, the starting point is Macomb County, but I have to tell you, the starting point is not Macomb County. It goes, I was, at the time that I was doing this, I was the associate director of the Southern African Research Program at Yale, and had written books on comparative politics and racial and ethnic conflict. But at the heart of the work that I did on ethnic conflict was trying to understand the white union, trade unionists, particularly in the mining industry in South Africa, but also to understand the steel workers in Alabama. And part of what was the heart of that book was trying to explain why it is that workers who were reared frequently in strong socialist traditions, but certainly in strong unionist traditions, used their position in the labor market, used race as part of the way they protected their position and advanced their interests in the labor market and in their negotiations with employers. I actually do believe a very important part of what enabled me to do the work in Macomb County, and probably be a pollster, was accepting that people that were in that period reviled by elite opinion, establishment opinion, because of their racist views, but was able to listen to them in that context and try to understand why they were reacting to that situation, other than the fact that they were prejudiced. Because the main argument of the book was that you could explain about 90% of the behavior of the workers in Alabama and South Africa, or the Histadrut in Israel, and Jewish workers in Israel, you could understand about 90%. You do not need nationalist or racial theories to explain their behavior. It was very much rooted in social democratic and labor thought. And in some sense, then, when I say that I began Macomb County then, which is then taking me to Alabama, South Africa, and Israel, it also begins with Gramsci, which I was teaching at the time, began writing about, because what very much at the heart of my work is trying to understand how it is that conservative parties or how governments in periods where market economies are dominant are able to bring working class voters along in the process. Very important in understanding American history, but I think important to understanding any the history in any of these countries, where working class voters vote for center-right parties and are very much part of the contested political space, even though you'd expect that they would that working class would be would instinctively go to the left. In the United States, that has, and particularly when one looks at the period of the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan was winning in landslide, the working class was delivering that vote, whether it was Catholic suburban voters in the North, or whether it was Baptist rural white voters in the South. White working class voters were the voters that were moving over to the Republicans in large numbers, and Democrats were not going to be able to recreate a majority unless they could find a narrative that brought those voters back into the Democratic Party. I wrote about those voters. I won't talk about the findings themselves. That's you can read the book or look at the history. But the findings, while they caused a bit of a stir, and I became a bit of a pariah in the Democratic Party of the mid-1980s. Because, to be honest, the argument of simply the argument, because we had the Democrats had gone through the country, had gone through such a period of tumult around civil rights, and the Democratic Party had gone through such a transformation, giving up the South, which had been its which the Democrats had held for a century, giving up the white South, exchanging it for minority voters, becoming a party rooted on diversity and tolerance and civil rights is a very different party than the New Deal Party that had formally created its majority. But to talk about the working class voters who did not accept that consensus within the Democratic Party was not a popular thing, subject to raise, and not just not popular, it was believed that raising it, addressing those voters would be divisive. But that's a judgment, that's a decision. To make that judgment is to make that to say that we can have a progressive center-left party without a working class. To my mind, says that is going to produce a Democratic Party that will be culturally liberal in American terms, but will not be able to address the social democratic issues that are broadly necessary for the country to have a progressive course. The result was a Democratic Party that was increasingly suburban and based in amongst more educated voters and minority voters, and that got slaughtered in 1984, but also beaten handily in 1988, particularly when Michael Dukakis could not come to terms with these issues. When George Bush, the father, ran on issues like Willie Horton and crime and was able to exploit those race issues, because the Democrats had not come to terms with these voters or those issues, Michael Dukakis went from having a 17-point lead in the polls to eventually losing, I think, by over 10 points. But they had not, at that point, could not come to terms with it. For myself, I took the ideas that I had developed out of Macomb County and wrote about in that period, and did the U.S. Senate race of Joe Lieberman, who was the Attorney General at that time, the Attorney General of Connecticut. He ran against a Senator Lowell Weicker, who was an icon, immensely popular U.S. Senator, who had been a leader in the Watergate. It was a Republican, but had been a leader in the Watergate investigations, very, very, very popular. Joe Lieberman defeated Lowell Weicker, and a good part of the reason he did was because of his ability to bring over what were conceived to be conservative and moderate working class Democratic areas, what had been traditionally Democratic areas of the state that had become Reagan Republicans. Reagan Democrats. There's a whole central part of the state, what's called the Naugatuck Valley, that went over. Anyway, Lieberman was able to bring those voters back and defeat Lowell Weicker. It was only when that happened that the ideas that I had been talking about since 85 got addressed, paid attention to in a serious way. Because then it was not just that here's some interesting ideas. Here was a set of ideas that, when brought together with a candidacy and a certain kind of leader, could in fact win elections. That could well be transforming. I then was brought over to work with Governor Clinton in Arkansas. who was considering running for the presidency, but I worked on his governor's race in 1990. And then was part of the group that was there to develop his candidacy for the presidency, which began in the fall of 1991. Clinton is the center of a whole variety of changes that then take place in our politics. Now, you'll no doubt want to raise questions around this. Clinton put together the team that suited his politics. He was head of the Democratic Leadership Council, had formulated his views. Clinton was not out searching for a set of ideas. He had his own world view and brought together the people that would best be able to advance those ideas. He was a very politically sophisticated man who had thought about America, but who also had been elected in Arkansas over a decade and had thought about how one gets elected as a progressive Democrat in the South. And so he put together the team of people that could think about his project. And what the project was essentially was that we have to take the working class back. That we can't do this unless the Democrats, and frankly, this is a problem of the left everywhere. I'm working in Austria. I work in lots of places. And in Israel, the problem of the left being a party of the better educated elites. Is a problem of the left everywhere. The loss of working class voters it's actually less developed in Britain than in most of the other places I work, including most of Europe. But it was the heart of what Clinton had to do in order to win the presidency. And in doing so, he advanced on a number of fronts. One, the idea that won a profound attack on the Republicans for mismanaging the economy, but also offering an economic plan and an idea that Democrats knew how to manage the economy and create jobs. The second was that you could use government in a restrained way, in a social democratic way, but in a restrained way, to help advance opportunity broadly. So that Clinton ran on universal health care, probably part of what brought him down as well, but he ran in 1992, the project included centrally, an expanded governmental role centered on health care and offered guaranteed health insurance as a policy outcome, policy goal. And the third piece was a reassurance on middle class values. And when I say middle class values, I'm talking about working class and middle class values in an American context. But a reassurance on middle class values which centered on welfare reform and on death penalty, where Clinton spoke for the first time for a Democrat about the need to reform welfare and move people from welfare to work, and spoke about both Gore and Clinton being supporters of the death penalty, which was the exact opposite of the Dukakis, Mondale, Carter period of the Democratic Party. But those were two critical issues to reassuring voters that you could trust this project to, where you are calling on voters to manage the economy in an expansive way, an activist way, and also to use government to expand opportunity and provide much broader social insurance. But we could trust these people because they had our values at the center of their project, which was where welfare reform was a central, and crime were a central piece of that. The other side of it was a organizational side. Clinton ran began organizing in August, September of 91. He announced for presidency in early October of 91. He then gave what were called the New Covenant speeches, which were essentially captured his ideas on opportunity and responsibility, and which laid out his ideas. And he emerged ahead of the other candidates on ideas. Before the primaries began, became the front runner, but centered around the fact about his vision for where to take the Democratic Party in the country. The other side of Clinton was a organizational toughness that they carried through in the primary, in very difficult primaries, but also through the general election. And for the first time, where the right had been clearly the tougher, most focused, disciplined, modern campaigns up until that time, what the Clinton campaign took over was not just being the party of ideas, but also being a party that was self-confident and tough, and that you could not, the notion, there was a belief, and I've seen it in elsewhere in other campaigns, I've seen it with Barack, I've seen it in South Africa, that the people believe the way you run your campaign tells you something about the way you'll govern. And that's, I mean, Mandela was very conscious, of that, and so was Clinton. Says if you'll let people push around in a campaign, then you're going to let the country be pushed around. If you're going to be trusted to handle the government, you have to have a campaign that people trust. And toughness in campaign was central to that, and taking that back was a very important part of what made the Clinton campaign successful. What happened as a result of the Clinton campaign, both organizational and ideas being more important, was the collapse of the Reagan conservative project. In the three presidential elections, the Republicans have averaged about 42-43% of the vote through three presidential elections after the Clinton election, after and including the Clinton election. The collapse of that project is very much centered on Bush the father, and I mention that because I want to close with a little bit of discussion about President Bush and what he's doing and why I think he's doing it, because the 1992 is a searing experience for the Republicans to watch the big majority that they thought they had created with Reagan in the mid-1980s. Seeing that squandered, crushed for over a decade, has become consuming on how they proceeding now in this period. Now, from my own personal point of view, I'm not going to talk about these. I only just highlight them because you may want to deal with them in questions. In this period, I was dealing with the Clinton presidency up through 1995. But worked for Mandela and the ANC in the 94 elections and later in Mbeki, and working with Blair. I should mention, by the way, in terms of Tony Blair, Philip came down to Little Rock in 1992. We began to worry about after the convention, after we emerged in the lead with a very strong lead, we began to worry that that perhaps, because the left has been out of power so long, that we worried that the voters, when they got close to the election and they began to think seriously about really doing this, that the doubts would come to the fore and that they would not be able to get themselves to do it. And we worried that, in fact, that's what had happened to Labor in their defeat in 92. And so that we brought Philip down to talk about it and also do a seminar and to work through what happened at the end of the 92 election to see whether there was anything we should be doing to try to counteract that. He argued it was a very different dynamic, and what took the votes away at the end, given the amount of reassurance and other things that Clinton had done, we were just not in that position. And Philip played a fairly large role in dealing with the media, because the media campaign was constructed by that the Republicans ran in the end was one that was developed here and used by the conservatives, and so Philip was able to help do press conferences that went after that advertising, since it was word for word from the Tory campaign in 92. But what happened after that was that we had an arrangement, Democratic Party and Labor Party, where Philip would come observe focus groups in the United States and I would come observe in Britain, so that we could learn from each other in this process, and then I got drawn into the polling for Labor, and then I got trapped and have never escaped. We also then ended up being involved with Schroeder, and then with for Barack, and then Sanchez de Lozada and others in Bolivia, and working for the Venezuelan opposition and other things. If you want to talk about that, that's all a distraction from America. Which we know is the ascendant leading power in the world, with countries rushing to be on our side. But I should tell you something about America and its politics, because Even though you don't get the vote in those elections, what happens there has a great, as you know and appreciate, considerable impact on what happens in the politics in other countries in the world. What's happened with the Clinton presidency? Clinton, besides advancing his ideas, Clinton also was able to extend a trend with women voters that had become apparent by the late 1980s of women voters, and particularly college-educated women voters, increasingly Democratic, wanting a more secular party rather than the faith-based party of the Republicans, very pro-choice, and so then and Clinton accelerated that trend amongst better-educated, particularly educated women voters. What also happened in the 90s was a great acceleration of immigration in America, far in advance of anything here or anyplace else in the world in terms of numbers of immigrants, legal and illegal, and greatly increasing the diversity of the population and the electorate. And so that there is now a theory of people who have read a book by John Judis and Ruth Tashira on the emerging Democratic majority is that there is a plausible theory, maybe right, that the what's happened politically and the demographic trends are producing a Democratic majority in the country, in basically consistent with the Clinton Project, produced by increasing education, because we have a much higher proportion of people going to college. We have a much more diverse population now, with the white proportion now down to 70%, and a growing Hispanic population that has made that is moving toward 40% of the population in California within about 5 or 6 years. In Texas, New Mexico, or in the whole southern rim, including Florida, there's a large Hispanic population, but also suburban areas around the country have become increasingly Hispanic and African American, and so you have a substantial minority, and African American participation is very high, and so you have a large minority population, increasing educated population, and growing kind of cosmopolitan areas, large urban areas, but large, such as the Chicago area, most of New Jersey, you know, Denver, Seattle area, the significant areas of the country where the whole metropolitan area has become more Democratic, more globally oriented, cosmopolitan, and creating problems for the Republicans in diverse areas. And so you have almost for sure, before you have a presidential election, all of New England, where every state but one has gone Democratic for the last three elections, the entire West Coast, which has gone Democratic in the last three elections and longer for the Washington and Oregon. You now have states like Florida, New Mexico, you know, Arizona, states that have been quite Republican, but because of the large Hispanic influx are now. So you have, there's a serious possibility of Democrats on the current trajectory gaining a sustainable majority. That has produced a Republican conservative reaction, I think first evident with Newt Gingrich in the congressional elections of 94, but developed by Bush in his election campaign in 2000, but very much evident now. I'm sorry for the time. I'm going to stop with this.
It's fine. It's good.
The central idea of the Bush presidency is to correct what happened in the Bush father's presidency and recreate the Reagan majority in the country. And it's very systematic. The Reagan presidency represented and drew to that coalition working class areas, working class voters from rural areas and white working class voters, ethnics, as I indicated, from the suburban north. But the elements of that of the Reagan idea was that low taxes was appealing to working class voters and appealing to business, and brought those together in the same coalition. Religious faith and bringing religion into politics and fighting abortion, which enabled them to bring particularly the Baptists and the 25% of Americans who go to church every week into the Republican Party. And then the centerpiece of this was a view of America that was strong, ascendant in the world, willing to go it alone, assert its interests militarily. Strong military, increased military spending, America willing to use its power in the world in advance of its interests. Now, the problem with that for the future is that was 1984, and Democrats actually had a big successful election in 86, almost had a successful election in 88. The Reagan idea really didn't have a big majority, though they are trying to rewrite history now to make Reagan into a more popular president than he was in the later period. The key to Bush presidency is coming back in each element. By the way, each of these, the father undermined it. George Bush raised taxes. George Bush took abortion off the table, as his family was more apparently fairly pro-choice. Took abortion off the table, raised taxes, cut military spending heavily, ended the Cold War, and fought the Persian Gulf War, as Colin Powell would fight it, in broad coalition with the price, with the cost borne broadly, whose goals were determined by having a broad alliance. That is the inability to take out Saddam Hussein because of the coalition that was created. On every front, Bush the father undermined the elements of the Republican coalition, the Reagan coalition, and it's their belief that that's what gave them the Clinton presidency and the Democrats on the verge of their majority. So they are working to reconstruct it. He began running on tax cuts in the primaries. Bush went in his campaign in 2000. He has proposed tax cuts and more tax cuts and remarkably big tax cuts with producing very large deficits as far as one can see for forever at every opportunity. There is no problem facing the country for which George Bush does not propose tax cuts. If it's terrorism, he proposes tax cuts, tax credits for business. Not a joke. He doesn't even mind losing the battle. He will propose tax cuts at every point because he wants those working class voters back. And those tax cuts are for business, which he gives at every opportunity. The other pieces of this is on religious faith. I believe that they do some of these things in order to highlight the issue, even if they can't get it, because they are trying to communicate who they are as a party. So that I believe they will try to appoint a Supreme Court justice who is pro-life and wants to overturn the laws on choice. In order to have that kind of battle, in order to sustain the religious element within the coalition. And I believe they want a go-it-alone foreign policy. They're greatly increasing military spending. And it is my view that it's not just that they have a go-it-alone foreign policy, that they want to do it in a way in which they have to fight NATO and the UN to achieve it. Because to get a broad coalition produces what his father produced, which was a broad coalition, but does not send the signal that America will use its military power to advance U.S. interests, and that the people in the world will gravitate to a country that uses its power successfully in that way. So I think what they're doing internationally I'm sure they have a view of the world that justifies the overall policy, but I think you need to understand to what extent that foreign policy is part of a broader domestic strategy for trying to recreate the Republican coalition that they need in order to try to get a sustainable Republican majority. That's where we are in terms of American politics. I am not working for any of the presidential candidates, but writing a book about it, and will presumably get the chance in the general election to win for the Democrats again to hopefully give us a different global environment to advance our collective interests. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. That was tremendous. We've got 20 minutes for questions, I think, so we'll take them one at a time, and you were first up. So if you can just...
Stan, in a modern presidency, a lot of polling goes on, but you hear President Bush say, oh, no, we're not making decisions based on
Well, the question is whether the current White House is doing polling with support of the Republican Party, and then what is the and reflect on that in terms of my experience with polling in the White House and for President Clinton. First of all, I don't have very much information other than the fact that I know they're doing it. The way it has worked historically is that the parties pay for polling that's used in the White House. It's not very different from what happens here and in most other countries. There are some places where governmental funds are used for polling, but not in most, and not in most of the places we work. So the Republican Party would have on retainer. I think they have a couple people who did polling for Bush. Now they are releasing polling regularly arguing that there is support for their policies, either their tax policies or their foreign policy. And so we know they are doing it and funding it through the party. I don't know the scale of it. I actually think they probably don't do as much as was done under Clinton. I think they have a pretty clear strategy around their political project, and a lot of it doesn't require bringing popular opinion on in a legislative process. That the project has its own dynamic. My experience with Clinton, and it's always a question of whether in doing the polling, that the polling is driving the policies of the administration, and whether that produces a diminished leadership. I have to tell you, my experience, first of all, and I'll go back to the point I made earlier, Clinton knew where he was going, and he had many speeches that he had given before he ran for the presidency. Before any polling was done, he knew where he was going and brought the people to him that were comfortable within that vision. There's still a lot to do within that on how you get it best framed and how which things have priority and what sequence, and et cetera. In the White House, there are so many things that crowd out the public. When you get to a decision, whether it's the budget or other things, you get to that to the budget. For example, with the first budget, the question was, what's the scale, what's the size of the deficit, how much deficit reduction? That determined everything, because once you began committing so much of the revenue to deficit reduction, it kind of wiped out the possibility of doing other things. And so you have the fiscal constraints that exist on the government, or all governments in a global capitalist economies. So you have fiscal constraints on the government. You have elite opinion, which is very closely woven in. You've got lobbyists. You've got everything. The idea that the public has a lot of influence over decisions seems to me anything one can do to get them through the door in any way seems to me to be a worthy goal. What I had with Clinton was we had and I actually ended up more involved than I wanted to be involved. The arrangement I originally constructed with him was to spend 15 minutes each week just sharing with him poll data on what's going on in the country, so that in the midst of everything else that's happening to the president, at least it would be 15 minutes one-on-one where I'd let him know what people were thinking. That's how it started. He had a retreat of his cabinet at Camp David, which he asked me to come and speak. And at the retreat, he grabbed me and said, and also Paul Begala, and said, "I have a government made up of people who were not part of the campaign. I have a whole finance team, Rubin, Panetta, Reich. I have a whole finance team who played no role. Not only played no role in the campaign, they have no idea what my priorities were or my interests, what the project is." And so he asked us to get much more involved in order that somebody in the administration remember why they were elected, what the project is, on what issues they're going to be held accountable. And so that's how I got drawn, in. But but that was the role that I played. The other thing is that they brought in Rove, who is the principal strategist, and probably the comparable person was Cargill in the Clinton campaign. Clinton did not come into the White House. And so Bush has much more centrally brought his main political strategists and operatives into the White House to be close to him in the decision-making process.
Thanks. You're there.
In terms of the In which campaign did you advise Gerhard Schröder, the 1998 or 2002 one?
I'm having trouble hearing, I'm sorry.
In which campaign did you advise Gerhard Schröder in Germany, the 1998 or 2002 one? And could you tell us a bit about them?
98. and it was an article, and when he ran at the end with the anti-American. I've stopped and asked myself, what would I have done in that circumstance? Had I been involved in that campaign, understanding the opportunity that was there in opposing George Bush's policies, would I have advised it? And I concluded I would have, because I don't think you should be in that role if you're not going to be able to help the person win. But then the question is I've had that issue before. I've had that issue with Barack, where in the Camp David negotiations, where we're heavily involved in that process, working with Barack, but not selectively sharing information with Clinton and my government. And said at various times I paused and said, you know, this is a bit odd, but let's take the charitable view of this, that we both have the same goals and positive goals in mind, and this is the best way to do it. In the first election, both Philip and I were involved working with him directly. He was learning, I think, from what happened and anxious. I mean, that's who he was. I mean, Schröder didn't establish his identity in the short period of his campaign. That's who he was. He was very comfortable with the Clinton campaign and with Blair's campaign. And he had to deal with various reassurance questions on the economy, and which he did through business, talking about business. But he had very little relationship with the Social Democrat, the SPD. I take as a measure of whether a campaign now is going to be a success is on whether it has a war room. Now, maybe it won't be a war room in the exact literal sense that Clinton had it or that the Labor Party has had it. But the ANC had a command center. They wouldn't call it a war room because it would have been very threatening in that environment. But the Labor Party in Israel did as well, and we did in Bolivia in that race. But what it means is it represents, you know, central strategic and communications control of the campaign. And campaigns that have divided authority, usually when they can't centralize, there's a reason why they can't centralize. And it's usually because there's divided authority, leadership doesn't have control over party. Mexico is the worst campaign we've ever been involved in for the PRI. But that was a party that had a clientelist kind of a relationship with society, and did that in its campaign, and could not have a war room because that would mean, you know, that some particular force had control. And so you would do advertising in which you have 8 different tracks. Okay, we had one of the tracks, and they had another track that was for the peasants and another one for the unions, and it was the most disastrous campaign I've seen, because the organizational structure reflected, you know, the character of that, you know, that party. But going back to Germany, that was a case. And I think the difficulties they had in government very much relate to the failure to gain control over the party into his period as chancellor.
Okay, I'm going to go up now, up here, and I can come back to you. Yeah, but you,
yeah.
And then
I
you.
I want to push you a bit on your thesis about the emerging democratic majority in America. And over the last...
I just wanted to push you a bit about your thesis about the emerging Democratic majority in America. And over the last 2.5 years, the Democrats have suffered 2 rather major electoral setbacks, in both of which they suffered pretty serious defeats in middle America. And granted, Democrats may have an emerging majority in some of the, on both of the coasts and the major metropolitan centers, but I think the 2000 loss sort of epitomized, especially by Al Gore losing his home state of Tennessee. I was wondering, A, if you see that as a problem, and B, what can the Democrats do to overcome those losses in middle America? Thanks.
The question you raise is absolutely the right question. And I was citing a thesis by 2 authors who make a plausible case, and there are other parts to their argument, but they aren't making a case that the Democrats have a majority now. They're making the case based on the growing Hispanic population, which the rate of change is accelerating, not going down, the growth of secular population. In the last decade, while the percentage going to church every year is at 25%, the percentage who never go to church has gone from 15 to 25 in the last decade, and is comparable in size to those who go to church every year. And there's a very strong correlation between church attendance and voting. The education, again, keeps rising, and it is true that, I can show you the data on college education, is producing more Democratic voting. So they're making an argument on long-term trends. And what I argue, I've actually argued against the book, saying that's great, as long as you don't have to worry about the next decade of elections while we wait for these trends to, you know, work themselves out. What I argue is that the country is actually at a remarkable parity. That is, the two parties are almost exactly evenly matched. We've had, you know, since 94, you know, all the congressional, even the election you talk about, the last congressional, the presidential election in 2000 was an absolute dead heat, both in popular votes cast and in electoral college votes. They came within, you know, within about three electoral college votes of each other, popular 0.5% on the popular vote in favor of the Democrats. In the 2002 election, which went where the Republicans took control of the House and the Senate, you know, the shift we're talking about, I mean, if you think about the majorities that Labor now, you know, has, there was a 4-seat shift in the House of Representatives and a 2-seat shift in the Senate. I mean, this was a trivial, and the only reason why that was major is because the two parties were exactly even in both, virtually, in both bodies, and any shift is, and since it both went in the same direction, it was a big deal in terms of control, but it was not an electoral shift. If you look at the number of state legislators, you know, they're within, you know, a handful of being equal, Democrat and Republican. So America is evenly divided. That is the story of America right now. And the question is, how does each party deal with that? The way the Republicans are dealing with it is, essentially, we'll recreate the Republican coalition, which got squandered by the Bush presidency, and rebuild. Now, it's not just that. The heart of it is recreate the Reagan conservative majority. Now, they are also willing to do tactical things to add on votes. And the three tactical things Republicans do are pay off the seniors, so that you have this conservative coalition, but we will do hundreds and hundreds of billion dollars to seniors for prescription drugs in order to try to buy off the seniors. So you'll have, and in fact, I've watched the right, whether it's in Italy, I watched Berlusconi trying to buy off pensioners in the elections there, and I'm sure the parties here will vie for who pays off the pensioners. Because you can actually pay off pensioners without really dealing with any big ideological question. It's just money. Okay. So you buy off the pensioners. The other piece is Hispanics, that the Republicans are trying, because they desperately have to address this problem, so they're trying to do it through prominent appointments and the president speaking Spanish, and I don't think it's going to work, and there's no evidence that it's been successful. But and then the third piece is try through education to try to get the suburban women, bring back some of the suburban women through a focus on education. The problem with that has been that because they're spending so much on the military and on tax cuts, is they've had to cut the money that was allocated to deal with that. So they passed legislation, then cut the money for it, and so they've actually lost the advantage they built up on education. But anyway, there's a variety of tactics to deal with that. The Democrats have their, in some sense, a comparable strategy on the other side, that is try to pick off groups. I won't go through it because of time. The pick off groups, but also try to build the turnout of this existing majority. And try to beat the Republicans that way. The problem is this leaves neither one of these are sustainable majorities. I mean, this is a formula for very intense partisan loyalist politics that leaves more and more voters dislodged and alienated from it.
Okay, so now we've got 5 minutes, so I really want to rush for a little bit. Mm-hmm. It was you up there, and I want a woman. Sorry.
Thank you.
Then you. Okay, sorry. Then you. Okay.
What if I let all questions go and then I'll answer them together? Just for time?
No, just shoot them off. Shoot them off.
Two short points. Thank you very much. Firstly, your comparisons between the two of you are obvious, but you made the point that you felt that you and Clinton rescued the Democrats because they'd forgotten the working class vote, whereas our chair, I think, makes the point in his tome that the Labour Party had forgotten the middle class vote. I'd just like some comparison on that, if you can. The second point I'm particularly interested in, and I declare an interest, I work for Britain in Europe. We have a major problem in this country, and I know that you have one in the States as well, about the non-voters. And what I really want is your advice on how we can reconnect people who, to paraphrase, ought to be of the left on issues that they believe are not of interest to them.
You've got 1 minute, Stan.
1 minute. on the, I'm not sure I can resolve the first question, which is the, we use middle class rhetoric, but it's really working class voters that are the heart of the issue. It's voters, you know, earning in American terms under median income, which is $45,000, you know, without a college degree. Is where the focus is, the voters who have pulled away from the Democrats, we need to pull back. But they will but they will talk about middle class. If you say middle class tax cut, they will think that's them. But that has to do with the peculiarities of America, and I think the dynamic is very different, I think, on the labor side and broader in income. At the higher income level, Democrats are doing fine. I mean, we've been because so much of our fight, you don't have on the conservative side the faith-based politics that drives the better educated voters to the Democrats. So you have a very strong emphasis by this president, you know, on religious faith. That creates a counter reaction on the Democratic side. So the Democrats don't have a lot of trouble getting, you know, better educated voters. Our problem is on the working class side. Okay. On your question about engagement, disengagement, I'll answer it in general terms. One of the consequences of paralysis that we have, which is not your problem. You have parliamentary government. You have the ability to pass a budget and to you'll get judged, you know, for good or ill on whether you're able to make improvement in the public services. Since we have divided government and we have two parties at parity, we have big fights over issues, but they're almost always small fights. You know, so that the big issues are basically off the table, which is why people are more and more disengaged in the United States. So that you have a fight over prescription drugs for seniors. Meanwhile, you've got over 40 million people uninsured, and you have a healthcare system in crisis. But you can't address that issue because the system is incapable of addressing the healthcare issue. We have rising inequality. We have stagnant living standards for large parts of the population, even through the boom. We have environmental problems with global and national. We have lots of big unaddressed problems that the political system can't address. My proposal for engagement is to break this thing open by taking on issues that the system can't address. I'm of a E.E. Schatzschneider view of the world that if you create a different set of battle lines, which center around the issues that are going unaddressed, you can change the political dynamic.
Okay, one last question, which was that woman there. Sorry, I'm...
You had mentioned some democratic opportunities, particularly in the border states, but if you look at some of those media markets, Seattle, Las Vegas, Miami, or Dallas, they're very expensive. And with McCain-Feingold coming into play, how does the Democratic Party adjust to this? We're at a tremendous disadvantage now. How do we overcome that over the next 10 years?
Badly. There's a lot of American accents. The question relates to the change in campaign finance laws in the states. I'm going to use it to expand to an entirely different subject. We'll come back to it. One of the reasons why, and I'm not sure Philip has talked about, one of the reasons why there are a class of campaign professionals who do what I do is because of the absurd amount of money in American politics, absurd amount of money in a number of elections. So they have elections at every level, every year. With unlimited campaign expenditures, with privately financed, and it means that there are political pollsters, there are political media firms. That in most places you go in the world, there are pollsters, but they do commercial polling. Since elections are every 4 or 5 years, and there's not much money. There may be no TV advertising. You don't have those class of professionals. So the result is that the world draws on these professionals into their campaigns. And I don't know how healthy it is, but in any case, I think that's at the heart of it. What's happened with McCain-Feingold is that they've removed from the parties what's called soft money, large contributions above, I think, $5,000. So you remove that money from the parties and from individual candidates. And I should tell you, I'm for it, the reforms, because I'm for anything that shakes up the system. I think it was so corrupt that I'm all for, you know, I'm sure I'll have unintended consequences, and maybe those unintended consequences will produce even more change. But in the short term, the consequence is that it's exaggerating the money advantage that Republicans have, because one, they have more rich people who give to them, so they're able to raise more into, you know, contributions of $2,500 and $5,000. There's also a large soft money loopholes where independent groups outside can spend money unregulated. The assumption is Republicans will outspend Democrats 4-1, maybe 5-1 in the elections. And so when we talk about trying to win here, we talk about going against the fact. And right now, business assumes that Republicans are going to hold on to power for a long time. I think they're wrong, but they assume that. And so that all the corporate money is pouring on into the Republican side. And so there's immense disadvantage, especially within the system of campaign, you know, finance. Doesn't impact heavily the presidential election, because free media, I mean, what happens on the news is much more important than paid advertising. And any presidential candidate will have a threshold level of money to spend. The impact comes in the House races and the Senate races. It's very hard for the Democrats to win the Congress, given the scale of the money disadvantage.
Thanks, Dan. Okay. Dan, thank you very much. It was absolutely tremendous.